I don't know what to do about this. I mean, because we do have to use clinical material. It's the best tried and true method in which to inculcate analytic thinking in our students, supervisees. On the other hand, we are so indebted to our patients and their trust in us, and our responsibility as ethical practitioners not to divulge their privacy. Principles are what we're trying to teach. We're not trying to teach people. We're not trying to teach that person. The case isn't what I'm teaching. It's the principles in the case.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Barbara Stimmel. Dr. Stimmel is an adult and child psychoanalyst in New York City, where she has practiced for the past several decades. And our topic today is confidentiality. And in some ways, it's a very straightforward concept. Confidentiality needs to be absolute. You never say a word about any patient you see. And you sort of solve the challenge of confidentiality. And as Barbara makes clear in her paper and in her conversation, there's more nuance to it than that, because we also have a responsibility to learn, to teach, and to advance our field. And it's honoring the tension that exists between those two that is the basis of her paper and our conversation. Just a sampling is that she makes the point that when you use clinical material in a paper or presentation, your purpose is not to really be talking about a person, but to be using that person's experience to demonstrate a principle. And that distinction is important because it leads the listener to focus on the principle and not get all involved and stimulated by their curiosity about the patient. We talk about a well-known case where a famous author had details of his analysis presented in a presentation by his analyst with unfortunate consequences for all concerned. We talk about how presenting a patient affects the analyst's interiority, the inner experience of working with that person, who you select to present, who you don't select to present, what you choose to say, how you receive the comments of your colleagues. It's a far-ranging conversation. It goes beyond the issue of confidentiality. Barbara's vast experience and beautiful way of presenting her thoughts invites that. We take up her feelings about when analysts co-write papers with their analysand about the analysis. We take up the various disguises that people turn to. We cover a lot of ground. Barbara teaches and supervises widely and has contributed to psychoanalytic journals and editing and contributing papers in several books. She has lectured internationally. She supervises internationally. She's involved in Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, where she sits on committees, has taught residents, and serves on the palliative care team. She is on the President's Council of Sanctuary for Families, which is an organization devoted to women and families surviving domestic abuse and trafficking. She also sits on the Shakespeare Council of the Public Theater in New York. And that's just a sampling of the diversity of her interests. And as she put it, confidentiality is part and parcel of any clinical topic, regardless of theory and patient population. I hope you enjoy and learn from this conversation on confidentiality. I found it fascinating and worthwhile. Here is my interview with Dr. Barbara Stimmel. Barbara, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you. When it comes to the question of confidentiality, which is what we're going to discuss today, analysts, by and large, don't pause and ask themselves, is there an actual danger to anyone if I speak to this person about that person? Instead, we just sort of rely on a formula. The formula more or less says it's best not to do it. And your paper, that will be the focus of our conversation today, raises the question about those choices. You honor the tension in those choices. And you also mentioned that, as is so common the case for analysts, there are those of us who lean in the direction of the spirit of confidentiality, and there are those of us who lean in the direction of the rigid formula of confidentiality. And we're going to discuss the pros and cons of that. But one thing is very clear from your study of the subject is that there's great nuance to it. It doesn't lend itself to simple answers. And I want to start us off at the very beginning of this paper. It's called The Conundrum of Confidentiality, by reading your opening paragraph. You write, "Of what would an analysis consist if one of its essential elements were compromised? How does the need to protect our patients' confidentiality deform our communications? And conversely, how does the need to discuss patients deform their treatment relationships? Could we ever be sure that we would recognize the difference between analysis and fiction? What is this thing we easily label confidentiality, yet about which we have an uneasy consensus? And can we be sure of the answers we give ourselves?" You go on to say, "I believe it is important for us all to enter the debate, the fulcrum of which is poised on the contradiction between putting our patients' interest first when presenting them in order to learn, teach, and strengthen psychoanalysis, which recursively is also in the best interests of our patients. Solutions to this paradox are fraught with confusion and rationalizations." Barbara, I and we are turning to you for solutions to this paradox. So why don't you start us off?
I'll start with the unfairness of that expectation, since I don't
have,
I do not have a solution. I don't think, and I know no one does, in the sense that it's an ongoing, it's exactly what you just read. I would just quote myself and say that we must teach, we must share our clinical material in order to teach, we must preserve confidentiality. And I recognize the inconsistency of being able to do both at the same time. Let me. Can I start with something Freud wrote?
Absolutely.
In 1905.
Always a good idea. Go for it.
Okay. And the reason I'm doing it is not just because I am a classical Freudian dinosaur, as that may be at this day and age, but because he's really laying out the foundation of the issue from the very beginning. And then I'm going to mention the Hippocratic Oath. Freud writes in 1905. "Whereas before I was accused of giving no information about my patients, now shall I be accused of giving information about my patients which ought not to be given? I can only hope that in both cases the critics will be the same. and that they will merely have shifted the pretext for their reproaches. If so, I can resign in advance any possibility of ever removing their objections. Now, Freud was writing that in part because of the attack on psychoanalysis itself.
Sure.
But it's really an essential criticism concern throughout taking care of others, that we need to learn through their cases, we need to teach through their cases. This is true in medicine and law, in any situation in which people are taking care of other people. And I mentioned the Hippocratic Oath, which I quote later in the paper. I don't remember the exact words, but in it, you know, we know we're all familiar with first do no harm, but also within it is text that says, essentially, I shall preserve the confidentiality of my patients even after they're dead. Mm-hmm. So my only point is that this is a concern in ethics, in philosophy, in medicine, in healthcare, since we've decided to pay attention to each other and try to help one another. So I can't answer your question. I'm sorry.
No, you can't answer it, but you will shed light on it over the course of our time together. You set the tension between preserving absolutely patients' confidentiality for their good and the good of the treatment, and also the need to advance our learning and understanding. The part that that you do mention later on in the paper is also the tension between the aggrandizement of the presenter, because it may be natural to you to think of presenting in terms of advancing our field, and hopefully that is the case. But it's also the case where presenting is done for the benefit or the imagined benefit of the presenter. And that shifts the tension just a little bit. It's who's going to benefit from this sharing. And you address that. And I just wanted to put that out there as sort of coloring the tension. And maybe that's a good segue, because I wanted to read another piece that you wrote and then invite you to share with the listeners a well-known error of transparency in the topic of confidentiality. You write, "When blind concrete obedience to preserving patient privacy, some would say secrecy, rules, then students, colleagues, and analytic self-development suffer. However, when unanalytic, concrete use of patient material characterizes its appearance, then the patient and the analyst suffer." You write then, and I'm going to ask you to share with our listeners, because some will be familiar with the author Philip Roth, and some may not. Philip Roth, briefly, was a very well-known novelist, a figure in American cultural and literary life. He died in 2018 at the age of 85. He wrote 31 books. He won a Pulitzer Prize and 2 National Book Awards, and he also was an analysand. And let me turn the story over to you.
Okay. And by story, you want me to describe the paper that was written about him, essentially almost.
And the fallout from it, yes.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. The important thing to predicate this upon, I think, although it's independent of my thinking, but it matches, and is that Philip Roth himself and many other authors have stated again and again that my creative work is not an autobiography. And what happens is that his analyst, and I can say his name, it's in the literature, Kleinschmidt, wrote a paper about a patient, and in the description, anyone who knew Philip Roth was in treatment with him would know it was Philip Roth. But most importantly, Philip Roth knew it was Philip. It was as clear as a bell. It was barely disguised. And most important, even if it had been better disguised, which we can talk about in terms of the use of disguise, the analysand recognized himself. And that's our most important concern. And Philip Roth, in his rage, but his genius, converted it into a novel, My Life as a Man, in which he created an analyst named Spielvogel, who was a fool, and he fought back. It was a very, very well-known incident in the world at the time, and certainly in the literary universe, And the analytic one as well. Kleinschmidt had his office near mine on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I didn't know him, but I had colleagues who had been training with him. And he didn't see, at least going forward, I have no idea what his experience was after Philip Roth's response. I'm sure it happened in the analysis directly. And then, of course, the book, which had to come out a little bit later. He didn't see anything wrong with it. And I'm sure he was a quite honorable person. So I'm not discussing, I didn't include this, and I'm not thinking to discuss it, to talk about that man, but really to talk about the importance / impossibility of doing it right. You want to do it right, but how do you do it right? There are all kinds of solutions people proffer. Disguise, composites, change of identity, change of gender, change of sexual identity, change of anatomy, change of age, culture, location. I would argue that almost always the patient will out, if you know what I mean. The patient comes through and comes out. I don't know if this is appropriate, but I have a footnote in the paper in which this is a personal communication. Martin Stein was a very highly regarded and very brilliant analyst in the last century in New York. And he wrote several papers that were very interesting about analysts who write. He wasn't talking about it from the point of view of confidentiality, but he was interested in how we transmit information through, obviously, through writing. And he told me a story in which he taught at New York Psychoanalytic, he had many colleagues, and they would use a particular paper of his, a very highly regarded paper, as a teaching tool. And invariably, somebody in the class, and sometimes more than one candidate, psychoanalytic candidate, would ask the instructor, I feel like this patient has a whole array of unconscious, perhaps preconscious, homosexual fantasies and confusions about gender identity. And then Martin told me that the patient was a woman, and he had changed her sexual identity to a man. But he couldn't. For whatever reason, a perceptive reader or listener felt the presence of the woman. And I'm using that as an example about that disguise itself is problematic, because then what are you teaching? I don't know how the instructor then helps the candidate think about these things. And it's all false because the person's not a man. And I guess one could argue, I can take the other side, that it doesn't matter. We're using it as principles, and right, we can teach about. And I agree with that. I absolutely agree with that. That's not my main focus in this paper. It's another conversation about the distortion of the case and how that affects education. But for the moment, I'm thinking about the privacy of the patient.
Well, let me double down on your comment about principles, because you write very beautifully about it. And that was next on my list of things to read. And so I shall. You write, "Too often and too easily, cases are discussed as though a real person were in the room or on the page. If we are to listen, think, and speak as analysts, then we must remain vigilant to the significant differences between the consulting space and the written page. If the author-presenter keeps in mind that her patient is there to serve the discussion of principles of psychoanalysis, then the patient as a principle in psychoanalysis is less likely to be misused. If the reader-listener holds the line between the real world and the consulting room, he will be less likely to speak of the person and more likely to conceptualize the psychoanalytic process. When he does, he goes some distance in not intruding on the reality of the patient by speaking as though he knows him." And I think your notion of the clinical material is there not to represent a person, but to represent a principle, maybe a way out of this impossible tension.
Right. That's so interesting, Harvey. I like when these things happen, that which I'm about to say. Mm-hmm. I, this morning when I reread the paper, lifted out a few things I'd written as possibly fulcrums, of discussion. Uh-huh. And that's my first paragraph that I lifted out. That was a great mind. So, right, exactly. Well, at least curious minds, right?
Fair enough.
Okay.
Humility noted.
So you're, I'm sorry, but you're...
That seems to be your attempt to solve this conundrum, this tension, by focusing away from the literalness of the person to remind the listener reader that this isn't about this person who may not be this person anyway, but it's about what I'm trying to show about a principle that this patient evidences.
Right. You know, actually, I'm hearing it come back at me, so I can think about the writer who put this down, happens to be myself, but I can now see it from a different perspective from the outside. And that is that I'm really talking about the responsible. And I know I mentioned this elsewhere in the paper, but this brings it to the fore more powerfully. The responsibility of the rest of us in the community, not to go looking, not to try to figure, not to treat these as mysteries. I'm going to figure out who, you know, and I know people in the room won't know the exact, you know, the individual, presumably. But listen, as a person who's learning concepts about, for example, the Stein example of, about homosexuality and repression and shame and guilt and doubt and et cetera, rather than that man slash woman. And I guess it's interesting you pulled it out, because what you're really reminding us of, and that I keep saying in the paper, which is probably pretty annoying ultimately, is I don't know what to do about this. I mean, because we do have to use clinical material. It's the best tried and true method in which to inculcate analytic thinking in our students, supervisees. On the other hand, we are so indebted to our patients and their trust in us, and our responsibility as ethical practitioners not to divulge their privacy. So in this paragraph, I guess I pulled it out to help me emphasize the fact that we, and I know many of the people listening today are not practitioners, but maybe you work in different areas in which you're required to keep, quote, secrets. We can talk about that word if you want, because that's an important issue right. Also. But for the moment, just to say that, yes, principles are what we're trying to teach. We're not trying to teach people. We're not trying to teach that person. Right. I mean, the case isn't what I'm teaching. It's the principles in the case.
Yes.
And often I think one of the best ways of compensating for, compensating is a good word, for the dearth of reality about the patient is to include a lot about our own experience as the analyst, which helps the student identify with us as the listener. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. It raises a whole other series of questions about revealing what is otherwise kept in confidence, which is generally one's countertransference, imaginings and feelings right. And fantasies.
Right.
And you write about that in the paper, about what's it like, and you gave case examples from Judy Cantrowitz's work, about analysts who recognize themselves and also had feelings about...
You mean
about,
patients who recognize themselves?
Yes, thank you. Patients who recognize themselves and also learn about their analysts' countertransference, which they wrote
exactly.
about. And there's the topic of sharing countertransference willingly and intentionally and of sharing it inadvertently, which has its own challenges. You mentioned trust in the analyst. So we're going to have a real dance back and forth, because that was my next quote. And you wrote, "We also appreciate that trust in the analyst to maintain confidentiality is actually one of the goals of an analysis. In essence, the work is based on what the work is continually in the process of attempting to accomplish." I want to read that again. "In essence, the work is based on what the work is continually in the process of attempting to accomplish. This is not a simple or small point, since in order to help achieve this end, we must turn to our teachers, supervisors, and colleagues." It is certainly not simple or small point, and so I'm going to invite you to flesh that out.
Well, I guess then I'm going to talk a little bit more broadly about psychoanalysis itself. It's an irony, and I'm pretty sure Freud says it better somewhere, pretty much says everything better somewhere than most of us, but that we end the analysis by end, we come to what we perceive to be an appropriate time to conclude the relationship and the work. I don't think the word end is right, because the identifications of the other stay within both parties going forward, but
forever.
The relationship certainly ends, the meetings end. That conclusion should occur, hopefully does optimally occur, when the patient is able to do what they came there to do, which is based on trusting us, but which they can't do until they've worked with us for a very long time. Let me try and make that clearer, because I know it sounds more complex than it really is. It's very simply that we start relationships, we go into it with the hope it will work out, that we will become connected, we will trust one another, whatever their context. Analysis, which is not meant to be lifelong and ongoing, unlike a friendship, a marriage, et cetera, moves toward ending. It's what's built into it is that we're going to move ourselves to to trust each other more and more, know one another, learn each other's particular vocabulary and unique way of seeing the world. And when we've been able to do a lot of that, we're going to say goodbye. So it's a bittersweet situation, but it's really mostly sweet in that when it goes well, in that we carry the analyst forward, hopefully developed an analytic way of listening to ourselves. But we've moved on from the need of that individual because of the need of that individual allowed us to walk away. And I'm one who really doesn't like using childhood parental parent-child relationships to talk about analysis. I think it's silly, inane. But I do think the notion, what we do to help our children trust us, attach themselves to us, and leave us. I wrote a paper about the inverse, how the mother lets the child go through the Jocasta-Oedipus relationship. So that's what I mean. So to bring it back to confidentiality, the people whom we're helping love us, trust us, know us, use us, and leave us must trust us. It's that simple. Is that, I'm not sure, was that simple? Maybe I took too long.
It worked for me. Let me see if I add this piece and if it stays true to your intent. Is the trusting the analyst a shorthand, a proxy for also learning to trust oneself, which includes listening and knowing oneself, but also benevolently holding oneself as in relation to learning to do that with the analyst?
Oh, certainly. It's really all about the word transference, and it's very simple, non-analytic only. It's human interaction, meaning we identify with each other and we learn about ourselves. The more I learn about you, I'm learning about myself along the way. I have to be, because
right.
I can only know you through myself. So yes, it's mutual. And that's why many analysts, good analysts, will tell you how much they've learned and grown in their individual therapeutic analyses from seeing themselves working with that individual.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Something we haven't yet touched upon and isn't often spoken of, but you get to it. And that is, what happens inside the analyst, speaking of interiority, what happens inside the analyst when they present a patient, both inside them and inside the treatment? And you write, concerning the issue of presenting a patient, you write, the hardest part of the equation, because the most subtle, is the impact on the analyst's interior relationship to the patient whom she has brought forward. Pride, guilt, fear of discovery sit on the tip of the iceberg. Less noticeable, though, may be the simple fact of keeping a certain kind of secret from the patient. This is not akin to the private aspects of the analyst's life, which truly are part of the working through of the transference in the form of patient's fantasies. Rather, this hidden fact has to do with something the analyst has done with and to the patient, something actual, recordable, public. This must create a special bond or alter a confident attachment. Simply put, it has an indelible impact.
Right. You know, yes, I wrote that. I know what I mean. The problem with it, I'm now speaking as a critic of the limitations of expressing ourselves in any setting. The limitation in this context is that it will be so different in each situation that I can't really, and I'm unwilling, and no one I think should, make blanket statements. What I mean to convey is that once we select a patient for presentation for whatever set of reasons, and depending on the context, you know, if you're giving a Nobel Peace Prize, you know, I'm thinking of Philip Roth, who never got the Nobel Prize and should have.
Famously,
he thought so too. From something as extraordinary as that to presenting into a class you're teaching, you know, the patient, you've done something in your head, even if it's not major or you don't consciously afford it much weight, you've selected that person to be with you in a unique place and in a unique way. And that's what you have to pay attention to. So I hope I wrote it in a way that lets the reader consider that I'm not making pronouncements about what will happen. Let me simply say something will happen. It will have meaning. And it will have this kind of meaning with that person. You know, I was at a meeting at the American last year, I think, and we were it was this winter at New York Psychoanalytic, and we were in a small group, and we were talking about a case of a person had come from Iran and had brought the patient, as I went on to say, I'm realizing it now, I'm quoting myself in the room, she brought him with her. Hmm. On the ship, on the plane, and she carried him all that way. And that has meaning. And it's not that you can't or shouldn't or mustn't, but what you must do is note it, respect it, and figure out what its meaning is. Why him? How does it affect me listening now when I go back? Did I pick him for this reason versus her for that reason? And what does it teach me about the people I didn't choose? And what does it tell me about myself? And so it's really just a reflection of a good analyst's good working life and mind, which is, in this case, she, is pretty much almost always, not obsessionally, but continually watching herself, reflecting on her choices, the things she said to her patient or chosen not to say, the patients she's chosen to bring to the stage with her, the patient, she said, no, I'm not going to present him, I'll present her. So it's as important to look at why I chose her, but equally important is why didn't I choose him? And what might it tell me about the case that I can use productively? So it's not about regret even or concern about doing the right thing. It's about taking seriously that the choice to choose a patient in itself will tell you something about yourself, the patient, and the relationship that hopefully you'll use productively. Does that make sense?
Certainly. I want to go back to something you said. We're all familiar with the situation when a patient starts speaking of something and you're not sure if it's a literal thing that happened to them or it's an imaginary thing. And in any other situation, you would ask for clarification. But hopefully in a fruitful analytic situation, you tolerate the confusion, consider it as information, and sit with the wondering. I wonder what it is and why it's making it so vague. That's where I find myself when you told the story of this person brought this person from Iran. I have no idea, and in this situation I will ask, did this person bring a human being from Iran here, or was this just a metaphor?
It was a metaphor. But that's so interesting, isn't it, that you didn't know that, and that's not about you. It's probably about the conviction I have that person was embodied in some sense. Does that make sense?
Yes, of course. Sure. Yeah. It's always a chance to learn something, whether you ask the question or whether you don't.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm glad actually that you needed to have that clarified, because it captures what I'm hoping to convey, that these are real, quote, acts. The real person might not be sitting next to you, but he's with her, and that has meaning, and she needs to bring it back to her work with him.
As well as the comments we get from colleagues when we make presentations, that lives with us long after the presentation when we return to the office, for the better and not for the better, depending upon.
You mean comments about the case?
Comments about the case, yes.
Right.
Yeah. Right. You take up the question briefly about analysts who choose to co-write the clinical vignettes.
Excuse me.
Yes.
May I just say something about
Please,
what you just said?
Go for it.
That's another conversation you should recruit somebody to have with you, which is what we do in cases, and what we do is, now I'm talking about the analytic community.
Right.
What analysts do in the room and get real smart about the case when they don't know enough, and
for sure.
and how deforming that is. But that's another, but I think it's a very important one.
Oh, it's very important about how we are or aren't held by our community.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. You write about analysts who choose to co-write clinical vignettes with their analysts. And nobody can see you right now but me, but you made a sort of a guffaw face that I think should be put into the record.
It wasn't heartbreak. It didn't look like I was heartbroken.
Well, let me, I was so caught by, I'm struck by much of the beauty and care of your writing, but this was a mere two sentences in a footnote, but I made a note of it and I want to read it. And it's about the co-writing. You say, suggesting that patients writing papers with their analysts about their own treatment is somehow therapeutic seems to be based on a sometimes willful misunderstanding of the analytic method. This way of thinking would have us stretch the concept of co-construction to a clinical breaking point. Can you elaborate on that and your facial expression at the same time?
Harvey, let's see. Okay, yes. Let me make a little confession here, but I'm going to try not to digress. One of my friends said to me, don't go all over the place. But I do have to digress a bit with this footnote, because I was also addressing my concerns about co-construction, covering the concept, covering all kinds of, for want of a better word, let me say, mistaken notions about what a good analysis looks like. But what I meant in that with regard to confidentiality is you want to know about how the breaking point...
Go wherever you want to go. It's unpack that any way you choose. And don't worry about going off. It's all good.
Okay, thanks. To my mind, an analyst and a patient are doing two very different things, although in the same context and in many ways for the same reasons. They want to connect. They want to be helped. They want to help. The analyst is being helped. The patient helps and then recognizes it in ways. And I'm not just talking about literal, concrete ways. So the concept of co-construction has become attractive and appealing because, and it certainly speaks to, which is intrinsic and unfortunately has always been misunderstood, that there is an equality between these two people. There's no one is better than or more important, neither, I'm sorry, there's only two, neither is more important than the other or more powerful or more anything, except they have very different roles and responsibilities. So co-construction both helps us remember that there are two people who are working together and in that sense, collaborators, companions, cooperators, and yes, they are making the same thing of they're building something together, but they're putting in different pieces. I was watching my granddaughters do Legos last week, and they were focusing on different parts of the building. And the one who was doing the kitchen was so excited about what was in the kitchen. The one that was doing the garage had a whole different set of ideas in her mind. Not a great analogy, but the concept I'm trying to say is that to go back to confidentiality, listening to my friend, you don't write a paper with your patient because I believe so strongly in that unless you, well, let me not, no, I'm let me stick to that point because you can't and you, the analyst, no matter how benevolent, loving, intelligent, careful, moral, ethical, you are, you're exploiting. It's as simple as that because they're not supposed to be anything. They're not your collaborator, your co-constructor of the analytic literature. They are part of the analytic literature. They cannot be asked to stand outside of themselves and do two things at once. It's just not fair. Don't think I'm being as clear as I'd like to be.
Oh, are you saying that in attempting to do that or to calling it something co-constructing, that you're depriving the patient the privilege of being a patient and asking them to do something other than that?
Right. That's another very nice framework. Yes. You know, I'm reminded of how it's changed in medicine. We all know that used to be cases where, you know, people were used all over the place, pictures and body right. parts and no sense of, forget informed consent, just the idea of privacy and personal space. But in the middle of all that, if you ask the patient to then come to the conference and start to talk about what it felt like to have a mastectomy and try to explain it. I'm picking something very dramatic, obviously, and very life-threatening, presumably the cancer, that, you know, very rather than a broken arm. You're abusing that person. It's an abuse. It's absolutely an abuse. They've come for you for care. They haven't come to you to... Let me say another thing. I'm interrupting myself because I think it's very important. I can hear the person arguing with me quite intelligently saying, well, that's that patient. For somebody else, it could be very therapeutic to talk to strangers and others about what happened to her self-image and her body image and her anxiety about death and so forth when she had breast cancer. That's true. The difference between that patient, and it's not, that's why the analogy, all analogies fall apart, and the analytic patient is that the analytic patient can never, oh, this is getting very complicated because I want to start to use clinical examples and then I'm going to, you know, create the problem I'm trying to describe.
Right, right.
The patient is not there in any way for the analyst's personal advancement or position in the world. And there's no way that giving a paper, teaching a course, publishing doesn't have to do with the analyst's own person. And it's obvious that people in analysis help their analysts through the very fact of the analyst learning about herself, et cetera, as I've been saying all along, as we all know. But I'm not there to get anything from this patient. And once I put her on the stage with me or her name on a paper with me, I've taken away that which is very unique and precious about our relationship, and that is that I'm there for her.
I hear you. That's what I meant earlier when I said I wanted to add that variable of the analyst's aggrandizement with presentations. And now that we're talking about patients participating, I think depriving them of the privilege of being a patient captures the spirit of what you mean. Because once they're performing, once they're, and first of all, the transference, as we know, never disappears. And it's always driven by transference, as is everything, certainly. But it's only in the analytic relationship where that transference, which guides all of us, is privileged as a focus of study and intended as a gift to them to learn about. All of which, it seems to me, is given up. And I think it may be given up under the illusion of the betterment of the field. I'm with you on this. I don't buy it. I don't think it's for the betterment of the field. I think there's more lost than gained by that.
Well, you know, Harvey, the only thing I'm not going to, of course, I'm glad to be agreed with, but now I'm going to kind of disagree with both of us and say that it's not always, it can't be, hopefully, I shouldn't say it can't be, hopefully, most of the time, it's not for the aggrandizement of the analyst that the analyst gets narcissistic gratification about being noticed, read, look, I'm talking with you now.
And are you?
That's okay, thank you. But that's pleasurable. And but if I it's inescapable, and there's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, if I weren't enjoying it and you weren't enjoying it, why are we doing it? And
sure.
then it's got another set of problems.
Right.
So the listener benefits. If the actors on the stage are having enjoying acting, it's only good for the audience. So I don't mind that the analyst feels a bit better about herself when she's done presenting. It's that when we present cases, it's sort of what I said about the patient coming from across the world. We have to understand that we're using someone. And we've got to be very, very, very careful about that. Very careful. I'm reminded of, I'm blocking her name, the very famous photographer who has photos of her three children growing up naked.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally unacceptable to me. To many photographers, it's gorgeous work. They couldn't be, maybe this is the best way to say it. Actually, this is the best way to say it. And I do have it in the paper, the best way for me. I do have it in the paper that because there are arguments to be made, to go back to the concept of confidentiality. You could ask patients when they enter your practice, I just want to let you know I'm going to be writing papers. Do I have your general permission to do so? You can ask the patient in real time, I'm writing a paper now, can I get your permission? You can ask the patient years later. Each one of those contexts, you're setting something up.
Sure.
You ask the patient before she's your patient or as she enters your treatment room. It's a kind of pressure that you don't know about, but they may feel they have no choice and they have to say yes. Person who grants this in open-ended ways has no idea what's coming down the road, and they may not want you to be writing about that, but they'd said yes earlier. The patient later, whom you call up and invite back to talk about writing about him, is a seduction of another sort. It's unavoidable, even if that's not your intention. And these are all things that mean that the person from whom you're asking permission can't give it, honestly, because she and he doesn't really know what's going to happen to him or her afterwards. The patient who's asked, may I show your x-rays at the conference? Your name will not be there. There'll be no identifying information. They won't even know, you know, they'll just see your rib cage. Okay. Informed consent in psychoanalysis is an oxymoron because there's no way to be informed. I will tell you something else. I don't know where else you wanted to go, but another thing I bring up in the paper, and I think it's very important, especially in this conversation you and I are having now, because there will be people with whom I won't be conversing, but who are listening will be having their own opinions. I've seen people heard in papers, panels, conversations, that the way that analysts who won't write characterize those who do, and those who do characterize those who won't. And they come up with descriptors, which are unfortunate. She's so rigid. She's got a very strident superego. He's a narcissist. He's a show-off. It's not fair. It's a behavior. It needs understanding. We're stuck also, I'm going back to the beginning, we're stuck because I supervise many people around the world, and I am listening to cases. Sometimes I use fragments of my own cases to make a point. I have chapters and books on supervision. What is supervision except talking about cases? So I'm doing it all the time. I'm not writing anymore about cases, but I'm certainly teaching.
You make the distinction between individual supervision and writing an article or presenting at a meeting. The teaching situation, the learning situation in supervisee and supervisor is clearly uppermost. Whatever pleasures both parties are getting, their function is to learn. And I don't think anywhere in your paper you question that, and I don't think anybody is questioning that. I think it's when you take it to a larger arena and a different medium that you want us to think more deeply about it. I want to read some of the closing paragraphs that summarize much of what's on your mind and what we've been talking about. You write, "We cannot elide the inconsistency of holding the patient's privacy safe in mind, while at the same time using her most private inner experiences to teach others. But what we can do is acknowledge the inescapable challenges and their attendant ambiguities, which is the surest path to better judgment." You go on to say, "The use of a patient to further the analyst's aims, or more benevolently, the well-being of her patient and her profession, will always have an impact on the analytic relationship. We can never escape the risk that the use of clinical material in one context will produce contradictory, detrimental results in another. Therefore, the question still nags at us. What is deformed when a promise, even if unspoken or undetected, is broken? Whether embracing the language of absolute or relative value, keeping our patients' confidences is a psychoanalytic professional ideal and essential to the analytic contract. It is not just telling of a patient's narrative, diagnosis, psychic conflicts, and compromise solutions that is at the heart of the matter. It is the application of a gloss on this behavior. Philosophizing, arguing, and wishing it away threatens to subvert standards of professional behavior and decency." And this sentence for me, Barbara, that you wrote says it all. "The inevitable falling short of an ideal does little to injure its value, but ignoring the descent degrades it." Read it again. "The inevitable falling short of an ideal does little to injure its value, but ignoring the dissent degrades it. I hope you enjoy your writing as much as I do.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice to hear. Thank you. It's worth all the anxiety of worrying about this conversation. But may I read the last sentence to respond?
As you like. Sure.
The very last sentence of the paper is, this is exactly a reprise or another way of getting at what you just read twice. Remembering that ego ideals are only approximations is our most effective bomb, our most effective soothing agent. We can never live up to an idea. We can't, because we're totally imperfect. So that sentence that you just read is like that we cannot, I'm trying to find it, escape. What page is that?
Oh, I'll read it again. I love reading that.
Okay.
The inevitable falling short of an ideal does little to injure its value, but ignoring the dissent degrades.
Right. Exactly. I want to say something to the listeners, because we're only, of course, picking up pieces of the paper. I don't mean to sound as rigid as it seems I must, because I'm taking a position about the very great problems in using our patience when we have to, but how do we do it as best we can? And we never can do it perfectly. And doing it is its own problem. So this sentence really reflects the whole paper, that we're not going to be able to do, you know, it's an annoying paper. And the title took me a long time because of the, you know, and I came up with the word conundrum, because conundrum are typically not solved.
Right.
And this is not something we can solve. It's something we can only do as best we can. So, for example, in terms of your that sentence, don't ignore the dissent, because you then going to degrade the whole principle. I said in the paper, and I've discussed this with you, Harvey, that when Judy Kantrowitz, I was one of the people she interviewed. I'm divulging something about her paper, but she interviewed several analysts whose clinical papers she enjoyed and wanted to find out how they brought those people to life, how they did it, why they did it. And I, you know, as I'm prepared for this conversation and happy to have it, we spoke for about an hour and a half on the phone. I don't think I'd met her before that, so she wasn't a friend. And by the time I got done talking with her, I knew I could never write another clinical paper again, because I couldn't. And that changed me. And that's what led me to think about this issue more systematically, because I had been doing something and I thought I did it well in the sense of disguise and care and all of that. Let me tell you, can I tell you a quick story?
Please.
About my first presentation? Okay, it was a paper I gave when I was a senior candidate, and I gave it at the American. I was, as you can imagine, like, oh, very, very anxious. And my husband, who had been doing this kind of thing for many years, longer than I, and was not at all, this was nothing for him, walked me down. He walked me to the Waldorf Astoria, where the American meetings used to be held. And he told me a joke on the way. And I'm going to tell you this joke. It's very short. And I don't remember the context of when we were walking, when he told it to me. But the joke is, two lawyers are walking down the street when they see a beautiful woman walk by. And one says to the other, what do you want to screw her out of? Okay. Now I get to the, for those of you who can't see, Harvey is actually smiling.
Yes.
It's not a riotous joke, no. But I just want to get a little credit here.
Yeah, absolutely credit. It's perfectly timed, right.
Okay. Anyway, so now I give the paper. All of you, whether or not you're in this field, recognize the anxiety of a student presenting to. And I had three male discussants, all of them senior analysts from the major institutions around the country. And it was a paper about the low fee. A patient low fee and money, and which went on to become a really major interest of mine in our work. And I presented my paper and sat down, and one of the discussants, when he was speaking, said a few things, and then he said, you know, and it was a very low fee in the case, and he said, you know, this paper, I think, is worth just about as much as what it cost the patient.
Oof.
Yes, exactly. Now Harvey's really making a face.
Well, it goes back to this issue of how we hold our colleagues.
Yes. Yeah. It was so horrible that his wife, another analyst who was in the audience, was the first to speak and defend me. But the reason I'm telling this story is because for some reason I have no idea how this happened, and I have no idea about the magic of my husband preparing me and giving me this gift. I said, you know, this reminds me of a joke. And then I told the joke about the lawyer, and what do you want to screw her out of?
Right.
Well, the audience loved it. I loved it. But what I realized later was that my patient was made a joke. My patient. Yeah, it was about me.
Yes, yes.
I was the analyst. I was the person that the lawyers are going to try to screw out of something. They don't want to screw me. It's not about sex. It's about aggression or money and all of that. But I realized that I had used my patient. I mean, much later, because this is very, but in thinking, and then I remembered it when I wrote this paper, I remembered how it really captures exactly what I'm trying to say. The patient wasn't hurt. So I'm sure she'll never know. As a matter of fact, I mentioned it in this paper here. I didn't publish that paper. I didn't tell everything in this paper about what I just told you. But I didn't publish that paper because I didn't know how to publish it and be sure I could protect her identity. But I'd already done something in public with her and used her to make some points for myself, to have a fight with a man. You know, I was very unhappy about it. So it's not just that there's an external reality that the patient will be hurt in the treatment. God forbid, she would have been, obviously.
Right.
But that I had abused something. Does that make sense? So
well,
I'm not saying this to be moralistic or to tell the rest of you not to write. I'm just simply publish or present. I'm just saying that was a bit dramatic, a little melodramatic, but it's probably not that uncommon. I don't mean the joke and the particulars, but the notion of how we use papers to present ourselves, to I think I've said it.
And I think you're, again, and it's an interesting mapping on top of each other, the issue of confidentiality and our regard for our patients' well-being, and the issue of collegial relations and our disregard for our colleagues' well-being. And it's been something I've been curious about for a long time, the ease with which people are cruel to colleagues. And it would be for you to decide whether you feel that Disgustin's comment was cruel, but it certainly was nasty. And
oh, yeah, of course it was nasty. But, you know, it's interesting because of the question that started, you know, that brought this association was about the degrading, if you don't pay attention
to
the dissent.
Yeah.
It's not that anything that happened in there was, forget that he chose to say that to me. I mean, for the purposes of this discussion, if I didn't stop to think about what had just happened, that's my concern. That's what I wrote that sentence about.
Yes.
Okay, I'm not going to live up to my ideal. I'm going to fall short. I'm human. I made a mistake maybe in presenting her or engaging with him. I could have just kept quiet. I still presented her. I still have all the issues. But now I used it a little bit more. But I have to pay attention to it. That's my responsibility.
Yes.
That's my moral responsibility. Is not to be perfect, but to pay attention to my imperfections so that I can get as close, which will always fall short, to being perfect, to the ego ideal. Does that make sense?
For sure. You know, I began by playfully asking you to provide a solution for it, and you responded quite appropriately by saying, I'm not in the solution business. I'm in the thinking deeply business, and you've certainly demonstrated that clearly. But I'll say you have provided a solution in the sense that while people reading your paper or listening to this conversation or people who know you won't necessarily conclude that I shouldn't write up cases, I don't see that as even an important outcome. But what would be important, which you live and breathe, is don't ignore the dissent. Don't ignore the costs. And whether that's be about how colleagues treat each other or how we listen to ourselves or how we respect privacy in patients, that's what, for me, the takeaway from reading your paper and speaking with you is. And that is a solution. The solution is let's think more carefully and more caringly. And for that, Barbara, I am very grateful. And I'm going to speak a little brazenly for many listeners. and saying that I think many of us will be grateful for your thoughtfulness and your emphasis on let's think more carefully.
That's very nice. Thank you. I hope that the people who know me best and sometimes are angry with me will remember that we, most of us, you know, you said something a few minutes ago, you said about your interest in that colleagues can be cruel to one another.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to diminish that by saying this only because I think one of the problems for psychoanalysts is they forget that they're also just ordinary human beings and people.
Yeah.
Very easily are cruel to one another. And we shouldn't think because we're analyzed and we know ourselves better, maybe in some sense more than the person who hasn't been analyzed, that we're better people. It means we're better than we were before, hopefully, mm-hmm. in terms of knowing ourselves and making better life choices. But I'm no better than the man sitting next to me on the bus who's hasn't read what I've read, hasn't been analyzed. Sure. I mean, I can be cruel, he can be cruel. And I guess that's why I'm writing the paper. I'm glad to end here because the whole concept of confidentiality is you left out when you read that chapter, that last bit, you left out the word constitutive. And I figured you left it out because it's a whole other topic.
Right.
But I just want to reinsert it at the moment, if you don't mind, because it means that many people believe, say a few of their names in the paper, that psychoanalysis is constitutive. It's comprised of confidentiality. It's not that we maintain confidentiality. It's intrinsic. And it sort of goes back to your early question about how do we end? And while we start off maintaining confidentiality and keeping our patients' privacy intact and not exposing them, et cetera, as much as we can and try to properly, the whole relationship and the development of the work is based on the basic, complete acceptance and expectation, this is between you and me. It constitutes the analytic relationship. And it doesn't, so all I'm trying to say to you now is that cruelty, confidentiality, kindness, love, sex, aggression, the whole thing that's the human experience is part of the analytic experience in words. Only in words. And we're going to fall short in every one of these areas as analysts and as people. Okay, but let's not stop thinking and talking and taking responsibility for when we do it wrong and being pleased when we do it right.
Beautifully said. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Harvey. This has really been a pleasure.
It has been.
I must say, I'm surprised.
I'm not, but thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Uh-huh. And I hope our non-analytic listeners understand these are general principles.
Sure.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.